a researcher specializing in intelligence agency involvement in multiple assassinations, propaganda, and other global criminal operations in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Your listeners are extremely fortunate to have you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media.
Chuck O'Kelly! Yeah!
So if you are hearing me on the live stream, we have gone live just a little bit late. Of course, if you're hearing this somewhere else, AM/FM podcast, it doesn't even matter what the day is. And guess what? Not going to even mention it. We're not doing current events tonight. I'm going to cover one thing before I get into this discussion, and I want to make it real clear. But we're going to try and do something real different tonight, because I want this to be like an evergreen piece that we're going to play several times over the next couple of months on regular radio through the live stream feed at O'Kelly.com. It's going to be there. It is a discussion about Vince Bugliosi. And I think it's long overdue, and I did push this off an additional week. Not Carmine's fault, but Carmine Savastano was with me, the author of Two Princes and a King. Also, Human Time Bomb, The Violence Within Our Nature. You can go to TPAAK, TPAAK.com. Find out about Carmine's work. Tons of articles over there. The two books. Find out about them. Go get them. They're worthy of your consideration. It's just that simple. Of course, Two Princes and a King is a concise review of three assassinations from the 1960s, but it's interesting how that might actually tie into what we're going to talk about tonight. And in case you're wondering what that pause was, it was me smiling. Okay, Carmine, I am going to handle something, but I want to find out how you're doing before I handle a little bit of, like, housekeeping business here before we get into the topic. But how you doing tonight, and do you have a feeling about how this Bugliosi show is about to go?
Well, I assume some people are definitely not going to like it, and some people are going to like it, you know, like most of our it is a device. I think it will be a divisive topic. But once again, you know, as we go into it, I'll explain exactly. This is not the first time, nor will it be the last. When this only comes up now, it's ironic because of the subtext of what's actually happening in what I see in some of the JFK groups is that a lot of times you're going to see in the JFK groups that people raise up people from their side as saints, and they try to make them more than human. They try to make them that it is indefensible to speak out against them. It is indefensible to claim that they never always told the truth, and that how could you question their judgment, because they have made icons of these people rather than learning about the actual human being and that human beings are flawed.
Yeah. And you know what's sad about that, Carmine, is I actually hold back on a lot of stories because I don't have evidence to back up some of the things that I could tell you.
Which is smart.
I mean, and that's the thing. I don't have evidence outside of my own observations in some cases. Yeah.
But sometimes the evidence does back up a lot of our observations.
That's a weird thing that we're going to find out about tonight because, look, I have often said when Vince Bugliosi came up, you know, he's dead now. But when he came up, when he was alive even, and people said, oh, but he's, you know, always been a guy whose reputation is beyond reproach. And I'm like, yeah, that's what they want you to think. And I've said that there's plenty of anecdotal evidence that I've collected and stuff that I know about that actually makes him not look like such a good guy. And I even supported part of his work that you know, the case against George W. Bush book, I forget the exact title, but I mean, I remember reading that and thinking to myself, you know what, broken clock, right, twice a day. Yeah. You know, I knew people that became involved with the whole Manson nexus of strangeness. Some of them I knew personally. And I talked to Charlie once. Not much to that story. I've told it. But thing is, I don't even buy the whole thing that brought him to international and national prominence as a prosecutor and made him a media star in the first place. I always said that. And people said, oh, you're one of those kooks that, you know, wants to
just,
forgive.
Yeah, that just hates him because he doesn't agree with it.
Yeah, and it's not, that wasn't the case. I mean, I do hate his book, and it did put me to sleep several times, and it was torturous to read it. But, you know, that's not enough for me to say he's a bad guy. He might have just been a bad writer, or maybe he didn't hire the right ghostwriters, but that's yet another story. That, again, I actually believe, considering I could almost guarantee I knew who wrote actually which part of that book, Reclaiming History. But anyway, this is not even the total point, and let me get a piece of housekeeping out of the way before I turn it over to you. I'll talk to you about the diseased nature of the conspiracy theory theater at this point. People approached me some days ago and started introducing to me the idea of the video of George Floyd is a fake and that he has participated in a bit of theater to purposely stoke certain fires in this country. And we want you to look at it because you're the kind of guy that this is direct approaches to me.
A la Sandy Hook.
Yeah, basically. They wanted to make it as though nobody died when we all heard that he couldn't breathe, that it was all staged, that, yeah, this is the proposal.
Well, we wondered where Q was.
Well, but I don't know people in Q, I think. You know, I don't know. You never can tell.
No, well, you never know. Who's who.
But it was so weird because I got these weird vibes off of people said, you got to look at this and maybe you can help us with it. And I looked at it and I said, if you're asking me, I've already examined this video. I examine videos like this all the time anyway. And I wasn't trying to prove or disprove its authenticity by examining it, but trust me, I've watched it way more than enough times to make myself sick.
Yeah.
And it's a legit video. It's
Occam's razor in this case.
Yeah.
Everything, for the most part, I would say, it appears to be what it is. It's violence. It's unnecessary destruction. It's people having been locked up in their houses for months based on what we can see now is largely irrelevant.
But Carmine, I see, I've been talking about this all week, and I actually
I don't want to go into it. Yeah, no, I'm just saying I think it's a lot of factors,
yeah.
And people are going to grasp for the video claims to try to explain it to themselves.
Well, you know what? I don't even think that all those factors which are true about that circumstance, I want to slice them away from this discussion because it's not the point. Actually, okay. When people see real world events happen that fly in the face of their preconceived desires to have things be a certain way, they will find an explanation, okay, to try and counteract it. This is the most ludicrous thing, and I'll tell you something. I probably could have made some money with one of the guys had I joined the chorus that is going to emerge. I warn you now.
Yeah,
that is going to emerge. There are going to be people trying to deconstruct this and claim that this is literally a false flag. They are literally going to claim that this is literally a propaganda piece, a piece of propaganda theater meant to turn you against the orange one in the White House. I'm just warning you now.
Yeah, the problem is that there's just so much misinformation and disinformation flowing from so many sources and amid the already ongoing chaos.
Okay, but you know what? Yeah. Stop again. I don't care. I am warning the listener right now.
Oh, no, warn them. Go ahead, warn them. I'm just saying beware. There's lots of stuff that's
going
to be out there.
Yeah, no, it's already going. I know it's going, but what I'm telling you is there's going to be a concerted effort here to Sandy Hook George Floyd.
Yeah. I doubt that there'll be a group that tries. Yeah.
I'm just, but watch for it, because I want you guys to know that I said this, putting it on record, and it is as of this date, and people will know what date. I didn't give the date at the beginning of the show, but you're going to know when I did this. It's going to be there, and timestamp it. Watch what happens. I'm telling you now that people that participate in this, some of them will be paid, and some of them will find it convenient to participate in it. And I can't go for it, and I'm not going to even engage to argue with them afterwards. I'm just telling you that you're going to see this happen.
What I would say, though, is my advice to these protesters is that when the dust settles, when they have another opportunity to protest, you need leadership. You need old school leadership from the civil rights movement that can show you how to counteract violent inciters.
All right. You know, again,
I'm just saying, you're going to need leadership if you plan on succeeding.
Why don't we talk about this after we're going
to
cover?
Some advice. They don't have to listen.
No, I hear you, but I don't even want to touch that subject. And I'm going to tell you, I disagree with your statement just now. I think something new has to happen here. I'll put it like there, and I'll tell you that it's not even my place to tell some of the people in this protest what it is they're going to do and not do. I'll leave it there. And not because I'm playing the color game.
No, I just believe humans can comment on other humans. I disagree with that line of thinking. Mm. I'm tired of hearing about white privilege. I'm tired of people telling me what I can't comment on. Mm-hmm. Freedom of speech. Thanks for playing.
No problem. You can do that all you want, but I don't think it's my place to inform them about this because I don't have the correct answer, and I do believe an innovation is required. Yeah. Nobody has the correct answer because otherwise there wouldn't still be the need to do this. Okay? Somebody would have either figured out the right way to shut it down or somebody would have figured out the right way to cure the problem.
It's
and
our
neither
nature,
one of
Chuck.
Which has happened. Okay. Again, discussion for another day because I want to get to Bugliosi tonight, and if you want to do an extra, we can do an extra.
No. I'm
okay.
What happened in my neighborhood? I'm good.
Yeah, no, I hear you. But again, my experience in a certainly diversified city, probably, I do believe, you know what, I forgot to look at the statistics, but I meant to look. I think I'm in a primarily black city, and no disturbances.
Well, that's fine, but that's anecdotal.
No,
I'm in a primarily black city, too. I'm surrounded. I've always lived in a primary. I lived in Detroit. I lived next to Inkster since I was a kid.
Yep.
And
I grew up
peaceful.
I grew up in a city.
I'm not saying most people weren't peaceful.
And I grew up in a city that spent 30 years destroyed because of the destruction in the late 60s. Asbury Park, New Jersey, never recovered until they gentrified it a couple of years ago.
And that's what's happened in Detroit, and that's what's going to happen again now with these cities. So the ones that get destroyed are going to get 30 years of depression to get back to where they were.
But not necessarily, because a lot of those cities that were destroyed in the late 60s bounced back nice. I'm just saying.
Detroit didn't.
No, Detroit did not.
Neither did
Asbury Park.
That's what I'm concerned about, is the long-term devastation that nobody cares about.
No, certainly. Yeah. But the majority of what I've seen across the country, again,
is peaceful. You're right. I'm not going to dispute that.
The whole state of New Jersey did not, you know, there was a little minor problem in Newark, but I mean,
I wish there were some more people from Jersey around the country. Unfortunately, there weren't.
I just state it because I'm so proud of it because I was from there and I expected some problems and they didn't do it.
No, and Detroit, I mean, for the most part, and I won't off-road too much longer, but for the most part, Detroit was totally peaceful. But there were people that wanted to take advantage, and those people were waiting. They were waiting for an opportunity. And now they have – what annoys me the most is that what this is supposed to be about is the death of Floyd, is about reforms, is about significant changes, and all of that is being cast to the side to focus on what violence the media can slam in everybody's face. Mm-hmm. So people are going to become more divided. This is actually going to create more racists because they're going to be scared.
Yeah, fair enough. And fear is exactly what that is about. But again, and by the way, anyway, BP posted in the chat room the breakdown. I guess I'm in a city where I am satisfied that BP would fetch realistic breakdowns here. 67.94%, I guess, is listed as African American according to statistics, and in my city, fine. I don't argue at all.
Well, and no, and what I see in a lot of these things, it isn't black people being violent; it's young white people.
Yeah,
it's young white people that think they know what the hell they're doing and think they're going to win this fight. And let me tell you, drones and hellfire missiles—you're not going to win.
No,
this isn't going to be a fight. It'll be a bloodbath if it gets violent.
Fair enough. But I wasn't trying to get into this and off-road into it. I want to go to Bugliosi because this I've been doing all week, and it's just – it's exhausting.
No. It's exhausting for you, I'm sure.
I apologize, but if you want to get into it in a bonus piece, we can do that live right on the stream right afterwards. But I want to devote the rest of this time, please, to Vince Bugliosi. And why? Because it's fascinating. The point you began with there where – people want to ascribe sainthood to individuals that they think agree with their position. I think it actually provides a greater context when we look at the actions of an individual and what they might suggest regarding their ethical endocrine system, for lack of a better terminology. And when I take a look at Vince Bugliosi, I always wondered how it was that people could look to him as an expert of somebody who is fair, balanced, and reasonable about what it is he thinks should be prosecuted, how he views the law. All of these things were attached to him as part of the reason why there was gravitas applied to him as a spokesperson in the media. Why was it that they turned to him to go get him to do that mock trial of Lee Harvey Oswald where Jerry Spence pretty much fell asleep at the wheel against him? Why is it that he was selected ever after? They would have him comment on major criminal things like he was somebody who knew something, even though he was from the L.A. area, right? And he was from one of the most corrupt law enforcement ecosystems in the country, in my estimation. Why is it that because he prosecuted Charles Manson. Oh, and also because he prosecuted other cases, and in fairness to Vince Bugliosi, like I said, the book about George W. Bush, I kind of could get behind. The fact that he was on board with the idea that the RFK case was likely not as the powers that be in his area had represented it, that indeed he felt as though that was actually a case that could be made for conspiracy in a legal way. I appreciate those sentiments, but when we look at...
I was just going to add, people can go back and listen to the show where we actually proved it was a conspiracy based on the LAPD's files, and they hit it.
No, Vince Bugliosi was not wrong about that. Now, it doesn't mean that if you take a look at the context of his actions and his respect for law and order and people's rights and actual due process and stuff like that, if you examine that in a realistic fashion, not what his bio said, not what his headshot said when he was, you know, offered up as an author who got $1 million contracts, who was a talking head on the media, somebody they went to, let's go to the great prosecutor here to take a look at it. Vince Bugliosi for many years was a go-to and a star for that sort of thing. And I, over the years, I would say when I heard he was writing the book on Kennedy and was supposedly a 20-year process, but when I heard about it, it was probably about 10 years before it came out, I was stunned to start learning about this guy. And a lot of it was anecdotes. And people reached out to me simply because I was part of the JFK assassination community and wanted me to know the character of Vince Bugliosi. Now, they provided me with anecdotes, and I don't disrespect the anecdote. It is a useful tool. But it's not something I can present to the public as evidence directly, usually, unless I've got a bunch of them and they have some other corroborating evidence. And I didn't have it all put together. I panned Vince Bugliosi's book. Of course I did. It's terrible. It, in and of itself, is terrible. Practically the only JFK author that he, like, doesn't go hard on, which is hilarious to me, is Jim Fetzer. And... you know what? Some of the people
speaking of Sandy Hook.
Yeah, speaking of that, some of the people he attacked, I went, you know what? You're right. And on other occasions, he was unnecessarily slimy and really redacted a lot of the, well, let's call it evidence to the contrary that he should have been well aware of. I knew where he was getting some of his reference material from. Him and I shopping at the same mail order bookstore in Pennsylvania, even, right? Okay. And that's a true thing. The Last Hurrah bookstore, you'll see it credited in many JFK books, because that used to be a great source to go to when the internet really wasn't providing it for us, so we could get copies of older books and articles and other things that were associated to the assassinations. Andy over there ran quite the interesting library and entire collections from authors and researchers and people who just decided to write a book would end up in that place. And we even I got shared notes from everybody from Donald Thomas to let me think about it here. Weisberg, even a couple of pieces of things that he had worked on that I personally got from the Last Raw Bookstore. Okay. But the man only get, you know, Fetzer, well, at least it was a scientific examination. I'm like, did you read the book, Vinny? But anyway, other people have attacked Vincent Bugliosi for various reasons, and some of them had a couple of pieces of the same anecdotes that I did. But I never put it together all together because, well, you know, it was a little difficult to track down. However, seems as though Carmine Savastano found his way to some collections of evidence that I think a lot of other people haven't considered. And again, I think we should consider the whole of somebody's behavior before we make a blanket judgment about who it is they are, were, and could have been. And the fact is that Bugliosi had many years and certainly was an active prosecutor and certainly was part of the establishment out there in California, was a media darling of sorts for his specialized category of whatever you want to call it. But there's a lot more to the story. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to you, Carmine, and let you begin because, hey, we've only got about an hour and a half now.
Well, I wanted to ask, too, and I don't. Hopefully the listeners won't mind after they hear some of this. We might have to do a second episode if that's okay with you.
Listen, I'm all for extending it.
Just because there's so much to go through. I mean, there's a lot of information, and I don't want to leave out anything because, as you know, you have – sort of some of a history, you know, knowing about this guy. I used one of his, like, you know, as you know, that whole tome he wrote. There was one useful thing I found, which was the he had the name of the officer that was in the room that Fink talked about in New Orleans, the one that told people to get out or whatever. So that was the only thing. The rest of it, I would agree with you, your assessment. There was one little tiny detail that was of use to me.
Well, no, there is a useful index to his book. The index is kind of useful if you're trying to piece together a couple of specific names or places.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
It is extensive.
He was good at that. He was good at least making lists, very, very long lists.
Yeah.
Of information and facts. Well,
that is a good characterization. He was very good at assembling facts or like things, you know, like playing the game, you know, how many of these things go together.
Yeah.
Vinny was good at that. And why am I calling him Vinny? Well, you know what? Carmine might explain that to you in a minute, too, because he was always Vincent Bugliosi. And nobody could ever spell the name right. You can find it misspelled all over the place. I don't know if I'll spell it right when I put out the episode, but we'll try. There's more to that as well. That is true. He was able to do that, and I'm not sure that he was the one who did it, by the by, when it comes to that index. But I do know that whoever did it in his name was very good at it. Now, I do suspect he had an assistant that worked with him all the time. I forget the lady's name off the top of my head. If you would have asked me a couple of years ago, I would have known it because I was in contact with Roger Remington, who did a whole piece of a book called Biting the Elephant regarding his interactions with Vince Bugliosi and attempting to ask him questions about the book he wrote, which, by the way, it seemed as though Vinny didn't know much about the book he wrote. But look at Roger Remington's work for that. I think it's still available on Amazon. You can probably get them. And if you can't, there are used copies out there. It's called Biting the Elephant. It's got a plain black and white cover. And Roger Remington was a trained historian. So just one of those underrated things that does exist and something that I had a little knowledge about because I knew Dr. Remington. And I have lost touch with him, and I hope he's well, but he was a rather elderly man, and I know that his health was deteriorating, so I don't know if he is still among the living, to be honest with you, but his work does exist, and I do recommend it. Anyway, back to you, Carmine, because I want to get on this. Like I said, we got an hour and a half, and if we need a second part, we'll do it, but I'd like to let you go through as much as possible and shut my mouth now.
Okay. I'm thinking, Max, we get to the beginning of Manson.
Okay.
We'll see.
We'll see.
Okay, so we have prior discussed on the show not just the evidence, witnesses, and facts, but also those who played important roles in crafting narratives to support their beliefs. Jim Garrison, Mark Lane, and Roger Stone, each conspiracy advocates, have received due attention when they ventured from what could be proven into what they desired to believe. In the case of Stone and Lane, both men would eventually declare publicly obviously unproven and sometimes false accusations because it generated attention, money, and influence. Some who support the official story of the JFK case, too, have been critical of flaws in method and question their credibility. Indeed, many unverifiable and illegitimate assessments will decry people from both sides who are controversial because they have personal animosity. But I would contend we have only discussed reasonable ideas, evidence, and offered commentary on what seems most probable and will continue to do so. I have never met or took much interest in the lives of other authors, and many public officials, unless they cross my path in the evidence or claim a place in it that did not exist, don't really get my notice. So I want to start by saying, tonight we aim to do no different in a seemingly rare but necessary inspection of Vincent T. Bugliosi that has been called by some a famed prosecutor and storied public servant. Now, speaking about a public servant makes me want to offer this critique from the American Bar Association. The primary functions and duties of a prosecutor or officials assisting in a lesser prosecutorial role is to, quote, be an administrator of justice, a zealous advocate or officer of the court. Just in this brief statement, many requirements are set in place denoting the responsibilities and duties a just prosecutor must obey. They must administrate justice by only pursuing rightful cases. They must adhere to seeking justice without regard to a conviction tally, but the evidence discovered. And the prosecutor, quote, should seek to protect the innocent and convict the guilty. Consider the interest of victims and witnesses, and respect the constitutional and legal rights of all persons, including suspects and defendants.
Quickly, I want to just interject that among the people that you just talked about, surely, you know, Roger Stone, not a lawyer.
No.
But Mark Lane, a lawyer, however, never a prosecutor.
No, never a prosecutor, defense attorney.
As a defense advocate, interesting perspective if you take a look at his behavior in this regards. Jim Garrison, on the other hand, prosecutor.
Yes.
And I would apply the same standard to Mr. Garrison, who I don't recall if you said he was somebody who made public statements on occasion that were, well,
not factual.
Call them not factual. He did. And not just because he was badly edited, but sometimes he made statements that were a bit far flung from the evidence. I'm being generous there. And I'll be generous about Mr. Bugliosi here is, you know, on occasion, these guys will make statements to the media with a purpose. And it is perhaps sharply defined in what you just read. But the real world, not exactly the same thing. Sometimes these prosecutors make statements and it is for an effect. And
yeah.
I will grant Bugliosi the same leeway that I would grant Garrison and tell you that both of them violated the spirit and the letter of that ethical construct. Okay.
And I don't think many people actually hold up to that. But I think what we're going to see tonight is that some people don't even try sometimes. In fact, they do the opposite.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. I see, Garrison, you got mixed motives here. I think sometimes there was a lack of trying because he was frustrated. I think that sometimes there was a mistake on his part or misinformation that he took as legitimate. I think that happened, and I think that's provable. When it comes to Bugliosi, there is a possibility that maybe he was misled on occasion. But
there's malice, or we'll see it.
If you dig deeper, you'll find that there are maybe some cases where that is the only thing that you need to know. But in other cases, precisely, Carmine, there is malice involved in what the man was doing. So I just wanted to pause for a second there and say, look, I realize you talked about a couple of lawyers here, and lawyer automatically lowers them on the rung as far as what I consider
honesty
to be ethical individuals. But here's the thing. Officer of the court.
Not a coincidence most of Congress are lawyers.
Yeah, not a coincidence there either. Right. And I just want to say there is a lot of look. Nobody's going to be squeaky clean if they have a law practice long enough. I know that. Yeah. Not an idiot. Not an idiot when it comes to this anyway. Maybe other things. We'll see. Point is that, so this is not like we're looking for them to be held up to some impossible standard here and therefore going to attack on nitpicky-own kind of little things. About to demonstrate here, and it's really, really, really disheartening that somebody gets by being pushed up as this paragon of virtue in the media. And, as per usual, a lot of media creations are just that, and they are oftentimes fiction. So go ahead.
Yeah, and I have a little bit more to say from the ABA, but the reason why I'm putting this forward is because I want people to understand what the standard is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. You know, what the rules they are supposed to be following are.
And I think that's fair.
Yeah. Additionally, the prosecutor, quote, should know and abide by the standards of professional conduct as expressed in applicable law and ethical codes and opinions in the applicable jurisdiction. The prosecutor is not merely a case processor, but should provide service to the community. A prosecutor should, according to additional ABA standards, present material facts and legal precedents that are true, and if they should learn a statement or piece of evidence was invalid, they will disclose all details to avoid impropriety, illegal action, and to avoid misleading related officials. Mm-hmm. Even should the prosecutor locate evidence and facts that damage or even destroy their case, they are legally duty-bound to offer such evidence to the court for consideration.
Right.
These limitations are placed upon those whose society grants consequential state influence to seek justice because prosecutions can render the financial destruction, imprisonment, or death of an American citizen, and it will be enforced by law. Mm-hmm. Yet the main challenge is prosecutors are humans and often personally invest both ego and future ambitions within the role, and this erodes their commitment to obeying the requisite limitations enacted to promote justice. What might just be bias or mere misdeed for a citizen is feasibly illegal and criminal if a prosecutor knowingly deviates from the law to feed their personal desires.
Right. Now, this is often represented in discussions where the defense is generally allowed to withhold information which might be beneficial to the prosecution.
Incriminate them under the Fourth Amendment.
Right. Now, there is
Fifth Amendment.
Yeah, but there's a proper terminology here that comes into play about prosecutorial officers of the court. They are not allowed to withhold evidence that is, and the term, what is that term again, Carmine? Evidence. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, no, for what specifically?
That would be beneficial to the defense. They're not allowed to withhold. There's a term for this.
Suppression of evidence, I mean.
Well, no, there's suppression of evidence, but there's actually a specific terminology where, and this is something that goes across jurisdictions, this is just part of the construct of the court, where, generally speaking, the rules may vary in wording a little bit here and there.
Oh, discovery.
Well, there's discovery.
Yeah, I was going to say discovery. I mean,
There's another word, though.
Basically, they have to be utterly open with the court about everything they find.
Right. If they find evidence that even contradicts their own prosecutorial statements, their prosecutor's brief, their case, if it is a contradiction or something that could interfere with the assertions, they're supposed to provide it openly to the defense.
But unfortunately, most of them are concerned with their record more than they're concerned with providing all the evidence to the court.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right. Go ahead.
So, okay. So, Vincenzo Torquato Bugliosi Jr. was born August 18th, 1934, in the large town of Hibbing, Minnesota, that still has a last reported population of less than 17,000 people. His parents owned a grocery store, and Bugliosi Sr. later was employed as a railroad conductor. The young Bugliosi was reportedly constantly industrious as he cut lawns, helped at the family store, delivered newspapers, and undertook several jobs in his youth. He would attend a local high school and win the state tennis championships when he was 16, and transferred to Hollywood High when his father took a job there nearby. His competitive nature and commitment to relentless achievement in this new, larger setting, despite the costs, would be a significant force in shaping his life and subsequent career. Seemingly, Bugliosi yearned for the opportunity to excel above the entirely new pool of classmates and pursued his dreams of college with vigor. He married Gail Tulito in 1956, and Vincent now would move on to the University of Miami with a tennis scholarship and earned a bachelor's degree in business administration. Following his schooling, Vince went to infantry officers' training school in Fort Benning, Georgia, reaching the rank of, quote, captain in the U.S. Army. Bugliosi then left military service to receive a law degree from UCLA as the president of his graduating class in 1964. Vincent had risen from his large town, one slinging newspapers, to become the lead member of his graduating class at a notable academic institution, and his future seemed to be a gleaming promise of achievement. Interestingly, his middle name, Torquato, may refer to either Tito Manilo Torquato Imperius, an elected Roman dictator of the Republic, or Torquato Conti, a Holy Roman Emperor for his brutal campaigns was labeled the devil by his enemies. Mm. It is from these interesting historical origins and humble background Vincent T. Bugliosi emerged and would begin his life in Los Angeles with an eye for legal work. The freshly minted assistant district attorney Vince Bugliosi and his time in the Los Angeles attorney's office opened doors to his career, and that time would both amaze in the public and would amaze Bugliosi himself as he navigated his way among the corridors of power in Los Angeles. Bugliosi joined the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office and pursued his cases with a single-minded desire that led to a monumental legal career. He would in time reportedly win, quote, 105 of 106 felony trials as a prosecutor and had a 21-0 record in murder cases.
Hmm.
These astonishing statistics have led at least one book to refer to him as an icon of crime fighting, but such overwhelming statistics further should lead to skepticism by most who regard one more recent national average of roughly 70% being the average conviction rate and not Bugliosi's over 99% conviction rate. The same, ironically, is that some modern statistics award those paragons of virtue, the only places, you know, where you can get comparable paragons of virtue, as the book says, is in the Chinese Ministry of Justice.
Okay, go ahead.
So I'm just saying, I'm reminded of the nearly perfect conviction rate that Dallas DA Henry Wade was lauded for, until later it was revealed that such numbers could only be reached by illegality and deception.
You read my mind. Thank you. Go ahead.
I think that's a major point.
It is.
Anybody who has those numbers should be questioned. There has to be something going wrong. What? Nobody is that good. It just doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's a corrupt system already. I mean, L.A. since the 30s, they had mayors trying to assassinate people. L.A. isn't some paragon of virtue city.
No, not at all. As I said at the beginning of the show, coming from that corrupt ecosystem, that's how I'm describing it, of law enforcement in Los Angeles County at the time that he's working there, at the time that he's gaining fame and glory, automatically should make him suspect. I mean, because, again, you know, how do you grow up in a toxic environment without getting some toxins in your system? How do you grow up in mud without getting a little dirty? I'm just saying. Go ahead.
So, but I would attest, as I'm sure some people are screaming at us right now, this doesn't prove that he's a bag. No, no, it doesn't prove. In fact, some people say it makes him a paragon. But I, when you look at all the statistics, and I invite everyone to Google some of them, nobody has those numbers. Those numbers could have only been accomplished in the 60s. when things were so corrupt that people could get away with those numbers.
Fair enough.
Anyway.
Go ahead.
So, an important fact people fail to address because it would hurt their average is the overwhelming majority of successful cases are based on evidence collected by police and staff and not won by some prosecutorial magic. Yet the prosecutorial magic comes into play after considering that most cases are settled and not fought at trial. And unfortunately, many prosecutors have allowed that fact to dictate their behavior and policies. This further also demonstrates that several people in the United States and across the world, in every country, who are innocent in various matters will take a deal rather than endure continued prosecution, greater challenges, and all the social stigma that's a part of it. Prosecutors know this, and some use it to great effect when a defendant can be at their weakest and even against the potentially innocent if that proves expedient. Mm-hmm. Indeed, there are many guilty people who are charged and provided a deal that are fair, but this certainly does not represent an overwhelming majority of cases, and often as history reveals, we can see this. While some might credit a peculiar overwhelming margin of convictions to be good work, I would suggest looking into each case and determining if someone is supremely skilled or used questionable methods such as Henry Wade did. We too must question the significant corruption presented by the 1960s Los Angeles political establishment and their cavalier attitude toward corruption, and even that they had one past leader who was verifiably murdering rivals in the police department. There was a police chief who was murdering other police people.
Right. Right.
You know, these crimes were decades old when the new young Vince Bugliosi joined the team. And perhaps Vincent Bugliosi was among the skillful exceptions. But strikingly, there are portions of his story that legacy media have left out. That was, until recently, files used in some modern books on Bugliosi's role in politics and criminal history emerged last year. It is these files that we will venture into as we continue this review and reveal more aspects of the man himself. As I mentioned prior, prosecutorial harassment or manipulations of a verdict can be observed in extreme cases before the public, yet some prosecutors don't just limit themselves to using unethical methods. They too might dabble in illegality or utterly reprehensible behavior. Mm.
And that term I was looking for earlier, by the way, and I just couldn't pull it off the top of my head, was exculpatory evidence.
Yep, exculpatory evidence.
That's the thing. And there are slightly differing rules in different jurisdictions regarding how this has to be handled. But generally speaking, you can't withhold exculpatory evidence, even if you've developed it. Say, a witness that you've interviewed, just for example, a witness that you've interviewed and a proper interview was, you know, conducted, and you have somebody stating that the defendant was not present at the scene based on some knowledge that they have. Now, that is a piece of exculpatory evidence. If there is a photograph of said defendant, which is time stamped during the time the crime could have been committed, or there is possibly evidence showing that the defendant was not present, was not in possession of said thing, whatever it might be, exculpatory evidence cannot be withheld by a prosecutor. Yeah. This is a pretty general standard across the board. So I just wanted to make sure that that point was made, and it fits into context with what it is you're talking about regarding misconduct.
Yeah. And that's why I wanted to go – that's why I went in earlier to the ABA standards. Mm-hmm. But those are important because those are the codes which are supposed to guide these people.
Right. Right. Absolutely. Go ahead. Yeah.
With that in mind, the story of Bugliosi now proceeds to a strange episode called The Milkman Story by one lawyer.
Now, hold on a second. Not sure how much of this we're going to get through. I'm sure that you have picked out some nuggets of really fascinating evidence.
I really want to go through it. It's worth going through.
It is.
That's why I said we might need two episodes.
Yeah, it is absolutely worth examining, and no matter how much of it we get through tonight, I'll tell you what, I think we should provide a link.
Oh, yeah, no, I'll provide all the references. And like I said, one of the things I said to Chuck off air when we first, because I didn't plan on, some of the funny subtext to all this is I got, a few weeks ago, I was invited to a group where it's mostly people on the other side. It's mostly people who support the commission. Mm-hmm. And while most of them are very reasonable, some of them love to do this sainting that I brought up earlier.
Right.
They love to put pictures of people that have supported their side and then just heap praise upon them, but never really put any evidence up.
Well, like Vince, people that are very much on the side of the Warren Commission got it right, even though we've studied some things and maybe found some flaws, they got it right. That camp of individuals, St. Vinny, it's really
and
like...
It's like with the people on the other side of the Garrison. It's a mistake. Don't do it.
It is, but I'm just saying, it is funny that you can provide this balance of on both sides. Now maybe it's
Same thing's going on. I mean, as far as the sainting.
Yeah, no, but maybe my prejudice says I'm a little less inclined to attack Garrison than I am.
I'm not equivocating that they are the same person. I'm saying that we find ourselves, and this is a human thing again. We find ourselves wanting to find paragons to look up to. It's kind of like with religion. If we don't have something to look up to, we'll make things to look up to.
You see, and even a guy that that we're not going to talk about really tonight, but just give me 60 seconds to run this everybody. Mark Lane, on the one hand, you cannot take credit away from him for making sure that the public got to hear something other than the official explanation. There is no way to take that away from him. He actively did that. He participated in media. He did presentations. He did speeches. He, appeared on campuses.
And some of his witness statements were useful.
And some of the things that he developed as a lawyer were extremely useful, extremely interesting. The motion picture,
the first one.
Rush to Judgment.
Yeah.
Was extremely evocative and provocative. It didn't get the attention that Oliver Stone's film got. But also, without Mark Lane, a lot of public awareness regarding the assassination would never have come to pass, I believe.
Yes.
Full credit
to him. And I agree, yeah. No, and it's like with... like what you mentioned with Bugliosi earlier. Some of them did some good things sometimes.
Yeah, but
other times.
Right, but here's the thing. A whole lot of dishonest crap Mark Lane did.
He misled witnesses.
Yeah.
He changed what they said when he publicly declared stuff. He misrepresented himself as being with the police.
Right. No, all that's true. You see, that's the thing. Is I can sit here and say that there were some, again, across the board, I removed the Garrison versus Bugliosi thing because it's not a fair comparison, although they are in the same
Lane
location.
Lane Bugliosi's more in sync.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that is. And sadly, we're going to learn, still again, I'm not hitting Mark Lane as hard as I'm going to.
If it's a straight-up judgment, I'm sorry to say, but once we're done, I think just with what we get through tonight, Lane's going to win the argument.
exactly.
But I don't want to argue who's better. I don't think either of them did the right thing.
No, I don't want to sit here and declare which turd stinks worse, okay? I'm just saying that
the same smell.
Yeah, that's what it comes down to, exactly. So... pardon me for interrupting one more time, because we're almost through the first hour, believe it or not. We've only got about, about 11, 12 minutes we can go, and then we're going to have to break. So I want you to try and come to a natural cutoff, but this milkman story, I almost see the next hour being dominated by what you're going to have to cover here just based on my knowledge of it, and you've actually read more on it than I have, and it is a deep, deep dive.
yeah. Well, and the thing is too is that you're going to be able to provide some of the contemporary stuff that was, you know, I mean, or at least you'll because you know more about him, the person, you know more about him as a person than I do. I just know these files.
Yeah.
So I guess I do know about him as a person to an extent.
Yeah. See, but that's the thing is you've got, you believe me, I'm going to have very little to say here. I want you to go ahead and drive through it because I don't want to get into the whole thing about what my personal view is on the guy. Because if you go there, I mean, I'm just going to attack him for 2 hours.
Yeah. And we should make this – I think that you took the right approach. It's good that you didn't try to ever do this with just anecdotes.
Right.
Let the people read the evidence and make their own judgments. That's
exactly. So that's what exactly what I want you to do because you've got it. And you actually showed me stuff that I was not aware of. And I'm laughing because
it's all Denny. All credit goes to George Denny, who rest in peace. He really did not like Vince Puglia's.
Yes, he did not, and he was rather motivated to collect some striking stuff. And go right ahead, Carmine. You got about 10 minutes.
Okay.
Bang
I'll get
it out,
start.
Please.
Yeah. Okay, so the Milkman. It began during an 8-month period during 1964 and 1965. According to attorney George Denny III, quote, when Herbert Wiesel was employed as a milkman by Arden Farms Company. During that time, one of the homes on his milk delivery route was 2992 Buckingham Road, Glendale, owned by Mr. and Mrs. Vincent T. Bugliosi. He continues, quote, on January 31st, 1966, a son was born to the Bugliosis. The account by Denny states, quote, more than 2 years later on March 5th, 1968, Deputy District Attorney Vincent T. Bugliosi made a telephone request to David Correa, an investigator in the DA's Bureau of Investigation, seeking an unlisted number and was referred to the person sought as a witness in connection with the case of People v. Fuentes, then began preparing for trial. It was a case that was under trial at the time by Bugliosi. However, there was a significant issue with the request. The person that was requested, who would turn out to be a complainant named Wiesel, was in no way connected with the case. The Bureau of Investigation records reflect that on March 7, 1968, Wiesel's address and phone number were unlisted, but the request was granted and the information was sent. For over a year, this information was nothing was done with it, and this request sat forgotten. Now, events began to accelerate in March of 1969 when Miss Rose Wiesel answered the first of many phone calls over the following months from an unknown person that, quote, refused to identify himself. According to Miss Wiesel, she received almost daily calls while her husband was at work. After recommending the caller seek professional mental help, she refused to provide the desired information about her husband. The caller was requesting that they could have the work records of Mr. Wiesel because they had a personal concern about him. Mm. So several dozen calls later, strange cars began to then appear outside the Wiesel home. These unknown people were watching them.
You know, objectively, just before you go any further and acting as though I have no knowledge where this is going, you might say this could make somebody nervous because they're being stalked.
Yes.
And why are they being stalked is the big question. I guess we're going to get an answer about that later, but you could see anxiety maybe rising in the Wiesel home, yeah? Okay. Please continue, Carmine. You're still there?
Yeah, I'll try to leave off at a nice cliffhanger before we go in a sec.
Oh, please go ahead.
The harassment and subtle threats would continue, seeking Mrs. Wiesel to convince her husband to give personal information to the caller. This was followed by them filing orders not to release their children to anyone but the Wiesels from school. Thus, for weeks, an unknown person was making harassing calls and demands to Mrs. Wiesel by asking her to help them obtain, quote, Mr. Wiesel's written authorization to Arden Farms to permit the caller to review Wiesel's personnel records. As the cars were appearing still, they now began to circle their home after several refusals and provide the unknown the Wiesels again refused to provide the unknown male with access to his legally private work files. And then Wiesel became, quote, frightened to the point that he sought advice from an attorney, Mr. Bernard Echt. The lawyer and distant relative told them to change their phone number to a new unlisted one.
Mm.
Following the number change, they wrote to, quote, Adhor Farms, Inc., the successor company to Arden Dairy, and made a complaint about what they felt was a breach of confidentiality. The complaint states that, quote, recently my wife and I have been receiving harassing phone calls from an anonymous male caller stating that he used to be a customer on my route back in 1965. Since we have an unlisted phone, it is quite obvious that he received our phone number from your office, and should we receive any further such calls, we will be obliged to turn this matter over to our attorney. Many days later, the Wiesels received a letter from this unknown person that began to lecture him about his lack of cooperation following the repeated harassment, stating, quote, this is an extremely simple request I've made to you, and your lack of cooperation magnifies everything beyond proportion. As I told you, I'm not accusing you of anything. I'm not accusing my wife of anything.
And what was that letter signed?
No.
Ah.
More unknown. Don't worry. We're going to find out the identity.
No problem. I know we are, but... It's odd because, you know, you're sitting there going, I got an unlisted number. Somebody's getting a hold of it. If there's more problems here, you're the only people that should have it. Don't turn it over to anybody. And if you do, we're going to, bring this to our lawyer's attention. Yeah. This sounds to me like there's probably more things going on here that weren't totally reported or accounted for regarding the stalking.
There's more to come. Yeah, this is, but I'm just showing that it's increasing now.
Mm-hmm.
It starts with just some phone calls. They won't cooperate. So then there's cars outside.
Well, and also rather suggestive here, because I'm not accusing you of anything or my wife of anything, which kind of means that according to that letter, somebody like Mr. Wiesel particularly should know who this is.
Yeah.
Am I right or wrong there? I mean, that's kind of the inference, yeah?
Here's a good, and maybe we can, we can go as long as you want, but I think that one of the key things about this is that an honest person identifies themselves. An honest person doesn't send you anonymous letters.
Well,
doesn't stalk you and make threats to you.
No, that's fair enough. But also the air of you need to cooperate.
Oh yeah. Oh no. Yeah. There's an undertone there that might be revealing about what sort of person might be doing.
Yeah. That's the thing is that this is somebody who feels as though they are entitled to cooperation, and they are entitled to the truth. And that's rather interesting. I know that a lot of blackmail notes are written in this sort of way. I've been privy to blackmail operations in the past, not saying any time recently, no sir. But when I was younger, I might have known people.
Nice. Never convicted, just like Scarface.
Exactly. That maybe sent letters like this and got paid for them or whatever. I might have. Just saying. And that's what it sounds like to me is you know what this is about and you need to give up something.
Yeah. Information. Why? And we'll go in because that's at the end of the, I can finish the letter if you want before we go out of the break, or I just figured where he talks about how
I want you to finish the letter.
Anybody.
I want you to finish the letter, but I want to make a point here that whether you are a criminal or you are an individual who maybe thinks they have power over somebody or whatever, that there is a definite suggestion here that there is an insurmountable amount of leverage and that you should just get in line and deal with it because there is a thumb on you one way or another. I mean, that's how I would read this.
Wiesel.
I'm just saying that's where I want to leave it and go ahead and finish the letter. Got a couple of minutes and we'll go to break.
Okay. So this is an extremely these are quite the interesting choice of words, I would say. Oh. And they belie an obvious obsession with the matter, that despite the author's claim that they didn't care, their interest was growing. Mm-hmm. They continue, quote, "If anything, you should feel sorry for me. Mm. There's no indication that you even know my wife or have seen her. But at the time of her accidental pregnancy, you quit work around the same time. We can observe the entire basis of this desired request is merely founded upon just the caller's suspicion, lacking any proof the two ever met." He admitted that in the letter. Well, yet the reason – I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, no. Go ahead. I was just going to say not just the caller, but the caller, author of the letter, and the very probable individual who is causing strange cars to be out in front of your house too.
Yeah.
Suddenly, you know, it just seems like it just continues on and on. Like there is a campaign of pressure. There's not a single effort to get some pressure on them. There is a continuous campaign, for lack of a better term, being conducted against them to pressure information to be divulged. We need this information now. And, you know, this is a simple matter. And by the way, I have no reason to say, you know, it's very fascinating because it does remind me of the way a cop talks to you when he thinks you did something. Look, I got no reason to think you did, but why don't you explain some things to me?
Well, if you didn't do anything wrong, then why won't you just answer the question? You know,
I mean, your lack of cooperation almost makes me think there might be a problem here. I mean, I don't think there's a problem. You don't think there's a problem. So there should be no problem with you sharing information, literally ripped directly from conversations I've had with police officers. So I'm just saying there is a general attitude here. Is there anything else that we need to end off with here before we get into the next hour and maybe find out who actually authored that letter?
Okay. Well, I'll conclude with this. So the author continued telling Wiesel, "It is comical in one sense with all the jokes about milkmen. If this happened to you, you probably would never even give it a thought. But it takes all types of people to make up this world. And unfortunately, I gave it a thought, although a very small one. Again, if the matter was a minor one, to the writer, he didn't show it. Seeking information unethically, harassing strangers for months, writing disturbing letters, and interfering in their lives was a long and seemingly involved process no mere small thought generated, but more likely a consuming desire that forced him to operate beyond the law."
Ah, and with that, we will go to a break, because I want to leave you with that thought. The Ocelli Effect with Carmine Savastano. And a focus on an icon named Vinny. We'll continue after this.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold. Silver. The stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough.
Maybe you're thinking about getting started.
WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Go there now.
Go there now.
Entertainment and more. You will learn something, children's. Ocelli.com.
We should learn from our relatively recent history, my brother. That's where I'm coming from. I say all power to the people.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media.
Ocelli. Second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins now. Of course, if you're hearing this on the live stream, you realize we've gone deep into the second hour already. Don't worry, there will be a full show. If you're catching the pod or the FM broadcast of this or AM broadcast of this, guess what? You won't even notice. So it is what it is. It will be a full hour. Carmine Savastano is with me. He's the author of Two Princes and a King, plus Guess what? Human Time Bomb, The Violence Within Our Nature. Both books you can find out about at TPAAK, TPAAK.com. I'm putting the plug in here for sure because guess what? We might run out of time and forget to plug it again. So both of those books worthy of your examination. Two Princes and a King is the concise review of three assassinations from the 1960s, but Carmine writes about a hell of a lot more, and you can check out a lot of interesting articles that actually have more information in them than many, many books do over there for free at TPAAK, TPAAK.com. So, Vince Bugliosi, we were discussing something in relation to him, obviously.
Yes, an anonymous letter.
An anonymous letter, and it was to a guy, a milkman, Mr. Wiesel, and his wife, who both were enjoying the harassment of continuous phone calls by unidentified parties, cars out in front of their houses, and the letter, which if you didn't hear about it in the first hour, you need to go back and hear about it, because
there's more.
There's more, but trust me, it's a good jumping-off point before we move further, and with that, Carmine, let's see how much we can pack into this hour. Go ahead.
Okay, so the message continues, quote, "In any event, now that you refuse to let me look at your records at Arden, I naturally am more suspicious. And the thought enters my mind that if you had nothing to hide, why would you care if I looked at your records?" This is a classic diversionary move employed by some people to demand information they have no right to. By stating, you would only deny it to hide guilt in the matter.
Yeah. Audio footnote. Go back to the conversation that I was just describing in the first hour regarding my interactions with police in an earlier time of life, where this kind of questioning, you know, if you got nothing to hide, you could just turn over this and that and let us look at this and that. And, yeah, it's just the way things are done. And it's fascinating because, again, this talks about the culture of
yes.
law enforcement, and sounds like that, but also simultaneously sounds very much like a leverage letter, a declaration given by somebody who might be trying to blackmail somebody else. And the funny thing is, it's neither here. But more on that as you go forward, Carmine. Please continue.
So perhaps instead this seemingly paranoid person lacking evidence and making demands had something to hide. A seemingly threatening line states, quote, "Why you wouldn't want to give me complete peace of mind, and why you would want someone to have the faintest suspicions about you, I don't know." It is then more possible threatening intentions are masked in commentary. Quote, "Your wife sounded very thoughtful, like an understanding person the first time I spoke with her, and I was very impressed with her. I didn't expect her to hang up on me later. I'll call again in a few days."
Yikes. Okay. I think the details of the letter stand already. I think people should read it for themselves. I think we can leave it right there. And you know what? Enough said. It is. It's just, you know, how many different. Look, first of all, I'm clearly the person who's been harassed.
There's just a little more. Hang on.
All right. Finish it. Go ahead.
I'll burn through it. Yeah, it's almost done. Burn through it, and then we'll get on to the next part. So these compliments are possible window dressing for the actual message. "I know your wife is home. You cannot stop me from calling, and you had better give me the private information I want." These suggestions are followed by the writer stating, quote, "I'll expect you to show me the courtesy of talking to me and letting me look at the Arden record so that this ridiculous matter can be cleaned up. Thank you for your anticipated cooperation. If someone asked me to do the simple thing I'm now asking you to do, I wouldn't even hesitate. I'd be happy to help them out."
Would you? All right.
Interestingly, this anonymous harassing letter author demands courtesy as they withhold their identity and make illegal demands. Perhaps this person who expected such blind deference had some legal training.
Or was aware that identifying themselves in a menacing letter, so to speak, might not be a good idea because it could be presented as evidence if the party writing said letter was... I'm saying you have familiarity.
If they were bright, they wouldn't have written a letter.
But you have familiarity with the idea that maybe somebody could go to the authorities about what you're doing.
And that somebody likes to write long letters to people.
Yeah, that too. Okay, go ahead.
anyway, during May of 1969, the unknown man showed up at Herbert Wiesel's new job, grilled the security guard about him, and this feasibly could threaten his job with a harassing stranger that appeared to make accusations. This, I would contend, was a message to Wiesel. This man could endanger his job and thus his means to feed his family, and Wiesel told the man that. It offers a callous and uncaring attitude for a man and his family, all to see the information desired offered. This person was acting like a vigilante on the warpath. Mr. Wiesel then determined to find out who the man was and deceived him by stating he would relent to his information request, but instead, when he showed up, gave him a letter from their attorney and used the trip to follow the car and obtain the license plate. The next day, around 11 a.m., a woman calling herself the wife of the unknown man appeared outside the Wiesel home and begged them to sign the release. It appears, having failed to harass or threaten the Wiesels, this person decided to send their wife to pull heartstrings for the cause. Mr. Wiesel states, quote, "She asked me for the Arden milk authorization. I became angry and told her I was sick and tired of this treatment. She said that maybe if her husband saw the records, he would be satisfied." The woman explained being, quote, "sorry for what her husband had been putting us through, but he didn't believe that he was the father of his own child, even thought the child was the spitting image of her husband," even though he was the spitting image of him. So imagine for a moment that after months of harassment and threats, failing, the person was now so obsessed and foolish they would give the Wiesels additional evidentiary ammunition with a personal visit from their wife. What do you think about that? I'd like to hear you.
Well, it's obviously a shift in tactics. He's not getting what he wants, regardless of the intimidation tactics. So now let's try a different. See, what I'm wondering, actually, is the mindset of the wife. Because, look, he only can harass you so many times a day. You live with this guy.
Yeah, she has to live with him.
She's living with the guy who is behaving this way. Just saying that, you know, she's also part of this because, obviously, she's being accused of something. And now she's trying to commiserate with the target of the...
Literally the battered wife thing. Literally.
Like... You know, don't make a big deal out of it because he'll hit me worse next time.
It'll be so much easier for all of us if you'll just do what he says.
Please help me. Help me and help yourself because...
Help me help you.
Yeah. I'm wondering about what was going... Like, really, I wish I could find out. We can't. I know that we can't because I happen to know who the wife was.
Well, but, and I have a feeling she wouldn't do interviews.
Yeah, but she probably wouldn't do interviews anyway for fear of the wrath of, you know. But anyway, so continue on, Carmine. Let's not keep hanging on it. What okay. do we have going on here?
Okay, so Mr. Wiesel screamed, "This man has been making our lives miserable. We have been scared about our children, and I didn't plan to sign anything for a guy like that." The unknown man's wife became pale when Mrs. Wiesel stated that she would take the matter to the DA if this didn't stop. The unknown woman replied she didn't want this to become public and began to cry and plead and state that she couldn't let her friends know about her husband's problems. Mrs. Wiesel then asked if the male caller was, quote, "seeing a psychiatrist." And the unknown man's wife replied, quote, "he wouldn't go, but that he knew he was sick."
Okay, that's interesting and all, but I gotta cut to it because...
Oh, well, I know. I'm going to name it in the next paragraph. Don't worry.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. The woman pleaded that her husband was not dangerous, but Mrs. Wiesel said that, quote, any man who denied his own child and accused her of the things he had, that he might be, quote, capable of harming children of the man who he seemed to be accusing of fathering his child. When Mr. Wiesel went to pick up his daughter at school that day, he observed the unknown man, sitting in the car on the corner, likely again surveilling them. The Wiesels finally decided to sue him after learning his name, but this threat appeared to subside for a time, and they didn't pursue the case, deciding to retain a shred of privacy if the man would stay away. While I wholly disagree with the decision, since they were innocently targeted, they likely didn't want their children forced to testify or endure further contact with this unhinged stalker. Mm-hmm. It was finally revealed the man was, with these strange demands, was named Vince Bugliosi.
Mm. But see, there's another part of this story here, not just...
There's more to it, yeah.
Yeah, and I want you to get to, not just because he's in proximity of their school.
Yeah.
That this is a worry now, not just for themselves, their personal embarrassment, what could be made of it afterwards, and how rumors and speculation might continue regardless of the resolution. But the other odd thing is that... they had a realistic reason for worrying for their children's safety, did they not?
Yeah, and we're about to get into it.
Okay, great.
So he worked for the Los Angeles DA's office. They did not have the ability to surveil him, and they didn't find out until then. They did not know Bugliosi had unethically obtained information on Wiesel repeatedly, that he had misused the LADA's office to do so, that he had repeatedly harassed and threatened his wife on the phone for information that he had no legal right to, and that everything happened despite no reason to believe it. Mm-hmm. Bugliosi repeatedly desired to know, quote, if Wiesel had been the milkman on the route at the time of Bugliosi's son had been conceived. Mm-hmm. It appears that a driving paranoia had pushed this notable lawyer to disregard his legal and ethical responsibilities and embrace the belief that his milkman could be his child's father. The problem was, no substantial evidence was ever presented. In fact, no evidence was offered at all. But the illegal demands for records and ceaseless illegal badgering of innocent people and their kids. The document states, the Wiesels, quote, began to fear for the safety of their two children, and notified their school that only they, the children's parents, should be permitted to pick them up at school. This fear, according to author Tom O'Neill, based on the statements of Wiesel's daughter, were founded upon a prior episode when Bugliosi allegedly picked up Wiesel's young 5 or 6-year-old daughter at school, brought her toys at a toy store, and then dropped her and the toys off at the foot of their driveway. And left without a word. Mm-hmm. Again, like before with his wife, it was a message.
A creeptastic message. Anybody did that to somebody else's children anywhere in this country, if you walked up to this guy and beat the hell out of him, at a minimum, if you didn't report him to the police, if you didn't do something in response to that, oh, wait, there's a problem. This guy works in the law enforcement field. You got an issue here. And even though he's clearly violated
multiple laws and statutes,
standards of practice within his own vocation, there is probably not much Wiesel is going to be able to do about this unless he takes it to a court, literally sues him, and gets, you know, somehow local law enforcement to get him to cease and desist.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the only way to deal with it, but these people are trying to just keep a lid on it.
Well, they don't want to have their children testify in a court that a strange, unknown man picked them up, took them to a toy store, and used them to threaten their parents.
Yeah.
Most likely.
Isn't that weird enough? But the whole thing is like, wow, it's very
Cape Fear.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. I didn't want to bring it up, but you know what it is?
Counselor. Sorry.
Yeah, wow. So anyway, what further do we know about this situation? Do we know about how it resolved?
Well, yes. turns out, as we can already see, he used all the wrong tactics and just disregarded ethics, mm-hmm. and he will pay for it. So the message, I contend, would have become clear. I know where you live. I can reach your children whatever I want, and you'd better relent to my demands.
But you know what's even weirder about this? Some people might say to themselves, all right, was there a point at which this wasn't so threatening, and maybe, you know, the guy, I'm just trying to play devil's advocate for a minute.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, please. You know, it's not a job I'd want.
No, I don't want the job, but I'm taking it.
You're brave for doing it. I really don't know what he has to stand on. It doesn't matter. You know, it's like.
No, it doesn't matter. You're right.
It doesn't matter.
You're right. You know,
he has no justification. He has utterly abrogated his duty in so many ways. He's totally. Yeah. He is the reason why people don't trust prosecutors.
Yeah, no kidding. But let's try and argue for a second.
Oh, that's fine.
It's hard, but look.
Well, it's a personal thing. It's we a can personal obviously thing. See the emotional investment.
Let's just say that he made an approach. And did this directly without, you know, cloaking his identity and everything else, because he honestly suspected the milkman knocked up his wife. I mean, let's just go to him. You know, there's ways to do this and try and make an approach.
And he took none of the ways that we should try to do it.
And he did none of the reasonable stuff here. I mean, he immediately defaulted to, give me the information. You're not going to give me the information. Let me ratchet up the pressure. Let me use, things that I'm not supposed to use for personal reasons to investigate you a little bit.
And when he named Wiesel in his requests, you know, because in the earliest requests when mm-hmm. we were talking about him as the unknown man made requests to the DA's office. Mm-hmm. So he falsified documents. He made up false charges about someone who had nothing to do with the cases.
Yeah.
I mean, there are crimes all over this. No. This isn't just he harassed some milkman. He harassed them. He stalked them. He kidnapped his child, if you want to get serious.
Yeah. No, he did. And that's the thing here. It's like, whoa. So what was
this?
It?
Is the guy? Yeah, this is Mr. Impeccable.
This is this is the paragon of prosecutorial behavior in America.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow. I don't think.
I don't want to sidetrack because there's so much to look at here. But if people want to know why people don't trust the system, here you go.
Well, here's the thing about it. Now, I want you to get to what we know about the resolution, because I'm going to add in something here. Let me add in something before you go further. Yeah. Believe it or not, I heard these stories 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
Well, I'm sure they've been kicking around since, not the specifics.
No,
but the
a version.
The story, at least in the press since the 70s, has been kicking around.
Yeah, a version of this story was certainly known.
Yeah.
And I even had contacts from people who claimed to have closer knowledge of it. And I'm not saying that I could ever verify. I just had anecdotes that were just given to me from people who said, look, do you know about this guy's background? Why? And like, so this is not something that was like really, really hushed.
No.
A lot of people knew about this, too. Mm-hmm.
That was just. Back then, there was such corruption, such open corruption.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I just want to make that clear that this is not some sort of like, everybody keep quiet.
No. This wasn't a conspiracy. This was known to quite a few people.
Yeah.
He just did a really good job of hushing it up.
Well, he did a really good job of it not being made, you know, the center of attention. But the truth is that, again, like I said, there's lots of people in L.A., in California, in general, that knew this story, some of the details, knew some of the people that were involved, and told me this. And I said, well, you know, I'll need something more. But they were like, look, it's common knowledge. It's there. And I said, I don't even know how to put this in context with anything. So I'm just saying this is one of the many things. And this is not the only thing, by the way, that people told me about, that they knew this, they knew this person. There's a bunch of stuff.
I think this might be, though. I mean,
this is outlandish.
When we get to the next episode, we'll go into something that is comparably egregious. But I think this might qualify as the most egregious, because there's just so many crimes and so much unethical behavior had to occur for all of this. Like, he repeatedly knew he was doing wrong, and he just kept doing it. He didn't second guess himself.
No, this is one of those cases where I believe one of the quotes from the email is from somebody who did work in the legal profession at the time and was made aware of this. They said that there is no way in hell that this guy shouldn't have had at least 15 charges brought against him based on what was known about this case. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, 15 good. I mean, and we're not
civil,
talking.
There might have been. Well, one would have been felony. It would have been the kidnapping. The others would have probably been civil, though.
No, there's actually a couple of felonies in there.
Oh, okay. Oh,
believe
okay.
it or not, because some of the possibilities about forgery.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Do lead to possible, depending on how they handle it.
Yeah.
There were possible felony forgery charges here. There were, you know, other things where.
At least false statements.
The kidnapping
yeah.
is a real charge, despite the fact that he returned the child unharmed, which he did return the child unharmed.
I mean, if they wanted to get serious, they could call in the feds for illegal surveillance.
Yeah, there's all that. But what I'm saying is, just in California alone, state charges, that I was told 15 is the number that he should have been looking at based on this person's estimation. I'm not even sure that's correct, but... based on what he said and based on what I've learned later, I would not be surprised to see a boatload of charges that at least could number 15. Even
well, and
back then
ethical disbarment.
Well, and then there's that. There's the other thing, which again, this lawyer did make a point of in that email. I don't even have the email anymore, but I attest to you that this was sent to me by someone who claimed to be a lawyer. I don't know for certain if that is all true, but this is the assertion that was given to me. That, you know, quite frankly, he should have been forbidden to practice law, you know, easily based on only like 5 of the 15 charges. And
rest. You can file one false document and lose your law license for the rest of your life.
Oh, yeah. But I mean,
he filed multiples. He made multiple false requests and all the other things we talked about.
Yeah. And some people get disbarred and reinstated. But this person was telling me that this would be like, no way you're practicing law again. based on some of the details that they knew about this. And I just didn't know what to make of that, you know. But I got to tell you, that was told to me a long time ago. And listen to what's happening here, folks. Yeah, why is it that people go, you know, I don't trust the prosecutors and their behavior, and I get nervous having to deal with these people. There's a reason why you're nervous dealing with these people, okay? And Vince Bugliosi is one of those reasons. Go ahead.
So, the account further states that following these actions and when Wiesel was recounting to authorities now that he had finally contacted people, what had occurred, he changed his phone number again, and Deputy District Attorney Bugliosi once more enlisted the aid of the Bureau of Investigation. However, this time the information was sought on suspect Herbert Wiesel. And Bugliosi sought information concerning the Wiesels of his new employer and received this information at the end of April 1969. Unknown to Bugliosi was the increasing, or just he didn't care about it, was the increasing paper trail that proved his irresponsible and unethical pursuit of Wiesel over a personal matter, using all the weapons of government to do it.
Also, civil action right there.
How
much harassment to the guy's job. After a while, you know, I know there's lots of labor law protections in a lot of places, but again, in context, at the time, not quite as exquisite as they are today when it comes to this sort of thing. But, you know, if people are continuously making accusations and trouble for you at work.
Slander.
There is slander, but there's also the idea that he's literally trying to deny him employment.
Yeah, because he's trying to prevent him from having gainful employment.
Yeah, if you are trouble, I mean, landlords remove people from residences because of this. Plenty of employers have let individuals go because, hey, look, just for one reason or another.
It's easier to get rid of the problem.
You know, you get rid of the, if you're not here, I don't have cops banging on the door every day. If you're not here, I don't have crazy people showing up. If you're,
well,
I mean,
that's what we should consider, is this is just one incident. How many times did he do this to people?
Well, that is the larger question. But what I'm saying is, just looking at this Wiesel case, there's all kinds of things that are happening here where civil and criminal action should be taken.
Yeah. And they weren't.
And they weren't. There's your spoiler alert here. Notice that he still practiced. What year was this?
Well, no, don't worry. Civil. Don't worry. We'll get to civil.
Oh, no, we'll get to civil. But what I'm saying is that the criminal prosecutorial mechanisms did not budge. And why? Because he's part of it. That really is the only conclusion I can come to, especially given other anecdotes. And there are numerous ones. This is not one obsession. Maybe he was going through a bad time in his life and his lithium level was off. Something. Nope. This is a pattern. And this is one of the most egregious and well-documented examples of it. But there is a pattern here, and that's going to emerge as you continue on. And, so please do.
Well, and before I do, I just want people to understand that, you know, Chuck will have all the references that will be attached to the show. But this may be, in my opinion, one of the most impressive documentary records of the misdeeds of a person I've ever seen. Because George Denny, with the help of some of the other attorneys, I mean, he has the deposit slips for the settlement agreement. He has all of the statements by Wiesel. He has Bugliosi's letter. He has statements from Bugliosi's wife. Mm-hmm. He has statements, as we're going to get into, from people who Bugliosi worked for that mm-hmm. support what happened.
Yep.
This isn't just some cheap slander job as people have tried to do over the years on other people. This is wholly documented. You can look at everything that happened. You can see that it comes down to this. Either all the documents are wrong, all these witnesses lied, and Bugliosi told the truth, mm-hmm. or what happened.
This is what happened. Yeah, and quite frankly, again, given the context of even trying to assume that there is not a pattern of behavior, you know, prior bad acts. Here's the thing. What years are we talking about here? Once again, Carmine, remind us.
Started in 64, went to 69.
Oh, so that would be before he rises to national prominence as the prosecutor of Charles Manson. Is that right?
Indeed. Okay. And it would also show that it was 3 years when he started before Miranda rights. So how much further did he go?
Oh, there's always that, too. But, hey, like I said, continue on.
So finally, after months of mistreating the Wiesels, mm-hmm. Bugliosi would offer a $100 pittance to buy their silence, and they refused.
Okay. $100 in... You know what? Please continue, but I'm going to make it a point right now to take a look at what that would be in dollars today as we speak.
He's the $100 man.
So go ahead.
So both victims recorded all these events in signed legal statements. They had no proven associations or problems with Bugliosi prior to his actions, and they were merely innocent people targeted by an unethical and abusive prosecutor that, according to his wife, was, quote, sick. And several documents and facts agree with the assessment. Years later, as the Manson trial was ceaselessly aired on television, mm-hmm. Herbert Wiesel became shocked at what he observed, but it wasn't the horror show unfolding related to Manson, but the person chosen to prosecute him, Vince Bugliosi, deputy district attorney. The man who had so blatantly threatened and harassed them worked for the very office entrusted to protect the rights of the public and seek justice for the innocent. Yet instead of, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to interject that for all of this, which Carmine is talking about, the $100 that was offered is equivalent to $720 some odd today.
Just, it's no 1200, but it's close. I said it's no 1200. But it's close.
Yeah, no, no. Hey, look, it's no 1200 is an obvious reference to something else. But realistically, $720. Okay, for harassing somebody for years.
Yeah, effectively, because they had to deal with them afterwards, going back and forth.
Yeah, for menacing. I'm just saying, $100 in 1969. Is $723 and wait, let me check. $723.87.
Yeah.
According to a couple of different calculation sites that do comply, that do comport with one another that I checked on. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Okay. Well, that was the opening offer.
No, fair enough, but I mean, you know, even if you're trying to haggle here.
That was an insult, basically.
But if you're trying to haggle here, let's give them benefits of the doubt all the way around and say, I'm going to offer you $1,000 to go away.
Yes. That would have probably been a more reasonable number to start with.
But even that $1,000, you know, then would have been, you know, what, $125, something like that? So $125.
$125 big ones.
$125. Watch, you can count them right here. you know that's almost not even a stripper club watch.
A new outfit, some shoes with that money. You could go buy yourself a steak dinner.
Oh my God! All right. Anyway, it's rough, man. I mean, you know, you harass somebody for years, you put them through all this, you abuse your authority. And, like, just imagine somebody doing this to you for a set of years right now, and it's 2020, and somebody goes, look, I got $1,000 for you if you go away. You know, Howie Mandel ain't going to get me to go away for a grand, okay? I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Wow. All right, please continue.
I don't care how good the pitch is. The pitch can't be that good.
Right. Not at a grand, not for your troubles. I'm just saying. Okay. Go ahead, please.
Okay, so instead of significant evidence, Bugliosi in this matter then continued to do the offer the reverse, and for doing this, he was appointed to prosecute Manson. So people in his department knew. People in the establishment knew that Vincent Bugliosi, according to his wife, was sick, was unreasonable, unethical, had done illegal things, and yet they still gave him the Manson case.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
In June of 1969, Bugliosi's career was supercharged with additional publicity, and he successfully qualified as one of two candidates for the position of District Attorney of Los Angeles. Herbert Wiesel stated, quote, based on what happened to us when Bugliosi was only a deputy and the actual DA and not the actual DA, we were scared of what would happen if he got into office. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. That's just, I couldn't help but like hold back my laughter there. I apologize. Go ahead.
That's fine. I called the DA's office and was in touch with one of his assistants. We met, and I told him what Mr. Bugliosi had done to me and my family. Wiesel would then learn all of Vince's illegal maneuvers, naming him a witness and suspect falsely to get information for the family using unofficial channels. Each false statement possibly constitutes an additional crime. Unfortunately, there were no honest prosecutors in the matter to do anything about it.
Well, let me ask you a quick question here. To speculate that now usually you don't like to do this because you want the documentary evidence. I know that.
Well, in this case, we don't have to.
No, we don't have to speculate. But let me ask you to speculate about something real quick because it's in my head and I just want to throw it out there. Uh-huh. Given that this is what we have evidence for, would it be insane to speculate? Would it be improper to speculate that potentially there is a great deal more abuse of power in this man's record? that...
No, I don't think that that would be a speculative... I'm sorry to say, you know, people can argue this, and I'm more than willing to look at any evidence they might have to the contrary, but this is a pattern of behavior. This is a pattern of behavior that was established in the beginning.
No, I got that. But yeah. Here's the thing I want to ask you specifically. Would it be improper to speculate that there is likely, very likely, to a high degree of likelihood, okay, that there is other abuses of power which are not documented?
Oh, sure.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. I'm just saying that usually when
you... And I think that's true in every instance.
Yeah, usually when you have evidence that does support a conclusion, there is generally a concept that there is potentially more that there cannot be documented evidence for. Just saying.
Especially in
that time period, given the circumstances, very easily verbal attempts to intimidate people, given his position, for personal reasons, that nobody had the ability to document are likely, given this pattern of behavior established in this case. Would you say or would you say not?
No, I agree with you. I think that it's more than reasonable to assume that this is not the full extent of all the misdeeds.
No, and there could even be potentially other actions which are unknown in this case.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. There could be more, of course. Yeah, no, there can always definitely be, as this series of files that people are going to get to look at later will show you.
Yeah, no.
There's certainly more to learn than most people think they know.
Oh, I know, but we haven't gotten there yet. I'm just saying that just from what we've dealt with so far.
Oh, yeah, no, just in this, I mean, people can try to dismiss what this means, but what would you, take away the name Vince Bugliosi.
No,
put any other name in its place.
Exactly.
What would you say about them?
Exactly.
If Mark Lane did this, what would the supporters of the commission say?
Look, we're not going to go there. But...
Well, I'm just saying, though. I'm saying that's what justice is. It's equal treatment.
Oh, no, but that's my point, is that obviously there was somebody who exploited their position of power to do what it is they wished. And in this case, they actually utilized the facilities which they had access to personally for personal reasons.
Mm-hmm. So they acted as a vigilante.
Just saying. And this all because, again, let me remind you, he suspected the milkman might have knocked up his wife.
With no evidence.
Okay, just saying. Go ahead.
A man who was trained to get evidence got none.
Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead.
So, they found out he was running for office. Hang on, I gotta jump back in the notes. So Wiesel would all this public information spurred the Wiesels into action, and they decided Bugliosi would be known to the public for who he really was. They scheduled a press conference and informed Bugliosi and his lawyer. Bugliosi, in response, created a, quote, spurious story about a supposed $300 theft that occurred in his home, his until now never mentioned suspicions about a theft, and Wiesel being the thief. And he contacted Wiesel and his attorney with the claims, but like all the others, they were evidenceless. And the fresh claims would appear the next day in the Los Angeles Times, most likely using his DA connections. It appears Bugliosi, never one to admit defeat, even in the face of reality, had decided to up the ante with new, seemingly false charges in his pattern of defaming Herbert Wiesel and harassing the man and his family. The Wiesels responded with a press conference detailing their account, supported by evidence and sponsored by supporters of Bugliosi's political opponent, and they declared he, quote, misused the power of his office to harass him for personal reasons. Wiesel denied the counterclaim of theft, but refused to specify what the personal matter fully entailed, which at the time I would imagine is understandable. He didn't want to publicly relive being accused of cheating on his wife, impregnating Bugliosi's wife, and stealing money.
I leave to the imagination of the listener what it is that you could reasonably claim he stole. Anyway,
nice.
Go ahead.
Yeah. The milkman delivers, anyway.
Yeah.
So, according to the LA Times, At the day's end, quote, neither side offered conclusive proof, and it remained another confusing episode in the election campaign between Bush, his opponent, and Bugliosi. Yet, the problems with Bugliosi's theft claims are noted by attorney George Denny, who states, Bugliosi's story relies on attributing Wiesel's employment to the period of 1966 and 1967, but Wiesel's last day working was in 1965. Thus, why did Bugliosi wait 4 years beyond any statute of limitation to do anything? He was working in the DA's office, and he was aware of procedure. Why did he instead embark upon his campaign of harassment if he was in the right? Why did he file a report, make legal statements, and not make legal statements as the Wiesel did? Why didn't he do any of those things? Why didn't Bugliosi not immediately report Wiesel to his employer or make any sort of complaint at the time? If he suspected Wiesel of theft, why did Bugliosi never mention it in any communication with him, to his wife, or to the people in which he worked with?
Okay, I'll offer you the weak devil's advocate for why the theft claim was offered as a counterclaim. You ready
okay.
for it?
Sure.
Okay, when you are confronted with a civil suit, strategically, one
yeah.
must offer a counterclaim no matter how flaccid, because it does what, in essence?
Hopefully distracts from the claim.
Distracts from the claim, A. B, causes legal expenses to go up on the claim, because
yep.
now you have the initial litigant having to counter your counterclaim.
Well, and I assume that the salary of an assistant DA was quite higher than the salary of someone who was
milkman.
A blue-collar worker like Wiesel.
A milkman. Okay. So, yeah, and that's the thing. This is a strategy employed by people like Donald Trump, who have been sued many times over the years, as an easy example. But, of course, many, many more financially sound people who are the targets of lawsuits do this. They throw counterclaims into the mix, anything that they think can get heard.
Yeah, anything to make you go away.
And this is part, you know, whether it's the $100, which is just absolutely ludicrous, not even a serious offer at all, or it's this, it is just meant as a legal tactic.
I think that Bugliosi mistook Wiesel's good nature for being stupid.
That could be as well, but I mean, he doesn't assume his lawyer is stupid.
No.
I assume. I mean, I'm guessing. I'm guessing. I'm not making an assumption.
Well, maybe he didn't think he could afford a good lawyer.
Well, that may be a possibility. And again, if you put too much of an onus on somebody in a involved in civil litigation like that, and they have to keep dealing with, like, they'll bury them in counterclaims sometimes.
Yeah. Especially if they like to write long lists.
Yeah, that helps. But here's the thing. As you pointed out, somebody who has access to the DA's office, somebody who knows about legal procedure, certainly would have made said counterclaim independently at some point.
And earlier.
And way earlier.
Until the statute ran out.
Yeah, that might help too. But anyway, go ahead and continue. You've got about, I'll say about 5 minutes here, maybe a
okay.
little more.
Okay, I'll try to tie a bow on it.
I'd like to tie a bow on this portion, and
yeah,
you're correct.
Portion.
We're going to have to do a part two in 2 weeks.
Yes.
Oh, go ahead.
If he suspected, so.
Because, by the way, folks, Carmine just touched on the tip of where Bugliosi's going to get involved in the Manson trial.
Yeah.
And there's more. So go ahead.
One would imagine a well-educated lawyer in a huge city might know how to do all these simple things. Mm-hmm. It's quite confusing. If he is actually the wronged party, however, if he is the problem in the matter, it's no longer confusing.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense. He would seek to malign Wiesel and his family to hide his repeated civil crimes and patterns of behavior.
Right.
Subsequently, the Wiesel's almost limitless patience finally reached its end. With the new theft accusations, they sued him. A suit for slander and intentional infliction of emotional distress was filed against Bugliosi, and they gave another news conference on the matter. In that statement, Wiesel offered, quote, I was never accused by Ardendary of stealing anything from Mr. Bugliosi's home. He added this new slanderous charge to the ordeal that he already put us through 3 years ago. My wife and I feel that he is willing to charge me falsely as a thief, to lie and hurt us and our children to win an election. We feel that our past concern for his family has given way to the need to show what the whole truth is and show what kind of man Mr. Bugliosi is. Mm. I dare say that they did it with Mr. Denny's assistance, and they did a fine job. Mm-hmm. They recount the pregnancy allegations, harassment, threats, kidnapping, and false charges. Attorney and Bugliosi files compiler George Denny took depositions from multiple officials in several jurisdictions where Bugliosi had abused his powers to pursue the Wiesel family. Mm-hmm. Bugliosi would attempt to explain his lack of filing a report or paper trail was due to his superior investigative abilities and needed not to rely on the police.
I'm sorry. I mean,
he said he was a vigilante.
No, basically, he said I can do better investigating this situation than the police because I am a superior investigator.
Yeah, who seemingly thinks he's of superior intellect, even though he did all those dumb things to implicate himself.
Right. Interesting. A guy who prosecutes people might know something about how criminals implicate themselves, but maybe ego. That superior intellect wasn't on duty that day. Go ahead.
Yeah. Denny, via statements, was able to verify Bugliosi's visits to Wiesel and his work, but Vince's wife denied any visits despite the confirmation of witnesses that had no reason to invent the encounter with his wife. Mm-hmm. Attorney Bernard Echt made a legal statement of contacting Bugliosi on behalf of the Wiesels, and Bugliosi admitted to the calls, the unknown person calls, mm-hmm. and said he would cease the harassment if he could just have the information he sought.
Wow.
He still wanted it. After all of this, after they were coming for him, after they derailed his election chances, he still wanted the information. Mm. Additionally, Bugliosi allegedly told Echt and fellow attorney Bernard Winsberg that his wife passed a lie detector test on the matter, but he was still unsure.
Well, devil's advocate position again.
For doing a lie detector on your wife? Hit me.
I know. It's not good. It is so hard. I try to balance things out. I really do. But
no, I do too. I'm not, like I said, I am making no personal judgments upon this.
No, you I'm guys, not trying to make
everyone
personal judgments.
Feel judgment. Free. Yeah, everyone feel free. This is just what the evidence says.
No, this is the evidence. But yeah, do think about the mentality of somebody who puts his wife through a lie detector test.
Well,
I mean,
and he used, I bet you he illegally brought her to a station or had somebody come to his home and give it to her. So he used resources to do it.
You know what? I don't have evidence that says that.
No, but unless he bought a lie detector test and learned how to administer one, I have a feeling.
Well, he could have also hired somebody to.
Well, that. Yeah. Okay, so maybe he hired somebody. Yeah, I don't know. If he's going to use resources for his other activities, why wouldn't he use them for that?
Well, because maybe they wouldn't give him that, you know. Lie detectors were seen in a different light in this time period.
True, that is
so,
true. Maybe not. Yeah, I don't put anything beyond the possibility of him doing.
No, I don't either, but I'm just saying that independently we must understand that he could
have hired
someone.
He probably did. You know what, maybe I'm assuming too much, but after false statements, the misuse of resources, you know, harassment, stalking, kidnapping.
No, this would not be beyond the pale to use somebody improperly who is in law enforcement to do so, but I don't have the evidence for it, so I'm not going to
tell. No, I wouldn't say that that's definitive in any way. I just said, based on his other actions, I don't, for instance,
Yeah. Let's just go with the mentality of a guy who's going to put his wife through a lie detector test, okay? Which I know that there are some people, we've been married to women, we would kind of like the opportunity to do so.
And then we would no longer be married to them if we asked.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It would have shortened my marriage, I'm sure of it. But thing is, okay. Let's just go with this for a second. Lie detector test may not be seen as reliable, but the fact that you were looking for evidence by doing so, I mean, this is so much tension and obsession being evidenced here in the actions he's taking that it is indescribable to me the level of dedication he had to this while he's doing a day job, too.
He liked to stalk and harass people in his free time.
Yeah, I mean, if that's what you're doing with your free time, perhaps you have too much free time. But anyway, I'm going to leave it there, man. Just go ahead and finish it out, and we'll close out episode one of something that might be titled like Reclaiming Bugliosi. I don't know.
What do you think of Reclaiming Bugliosi's History?
That may exactly be the title of this, part one. But we'll do a part two in 2 weeks, I promise you. But go ahead and put a bow on it, Carmine. You know, okay. A minute or two, please.
Additionally, I have a feeling that Bugliosi likely brought his wife to the police for questioning or misused department resources to do so elsewhere. But as Chuck said, it can't be proven. Based on the pattern of behavior, I don't think that's outside the realm of possibility.
No, and speculating in that direction is not improper, but just again, devil's advocate point of view.
No, and that's fine. Yeah, no. Hey, we're good on what we can prove.
Right, exactly.
It becomes exceedingly clear that Bugliosi seems not to trust almost anyone. Especially damning is that Winsberg, one of the people who Denny was able to get a statement against Bugliosi, was the former deputy district attorney in L.A. who helped Vince Bugliosi put on his first preliminary hearing and confirmed Bugliosi admitting to the harassment. Mm. So we even have someone from inside the system saying it. Mm-hmm. We have investigators from inside the system saying he made the false requests. This isn't just Denny. This isn't just the Wiesels. This is officials, too.
Yep.
So following the assertion, Bugliosi stated he would destroy their case and then privately contacted the Wiesels for a settlement with a new $500 payoff to keep quiet. Uh-huh. The offer was eventually raised to $12,500. Quite the increase.
Mm-hmm.
Almost as if someone finally realized they could not win. Having prevented the election of Bugliosi, the Wiesels decided to get back some lawyer's fees and gain something from the matter, and thus agreed to accept his final offer. I dare say, based on past obsession and unethical behavior, there is no reason to doubt his activities likely continued in his later cases with Manson and pursuits in historical inquiry. Bugliosi seemingly set his mind to a result and equivocated and invented stories when he was found to be in the wrong. Mm-hmm. The Wiesels would for a long while conceal their story as per the terms of the agreement that included payments in only untraceable cash, and no reference in the document that the money was fully paid. Bugliosi was effectively still trying to conceal the truth of the matter and give himself maneuvering room to later deny any factual but uncomfortable claims. We can see the repetition of deceptions and that he was learning to conceal his legal habits better with additional legal help. He also put in stinger provisions if anyone revealed the details of the agreement, hoping this would dissuade future fact-gathering. He certainly was concerned with the public knowing about this episode and structured the document accordingly. Denny's records provide the original documents with cash checks and deposit slips. This seemingly ended the matter with the milkman. But Denny states that Vincent T. Bugliosi just couldn't stay out of trouble.
There you have it. And we will get into more of that trouble in the next episode. I guess we'll reconvene in 2 weeks, Carmine. Would that be
okay? Yeah.
But for the record, as we close out, that final settlement amount is somewhere just under, say, $90,000 in today's money.
Yeah, a little bit more.
So
$100 to $12,500.
Yeah, that's quite an increase. But what did not decrease was Bugliosi's behavior pattern, as you're going to see in the next episode. But I thank once again Carmine Savastano for doing this with me. I think this was a welcome break from the current events, though, as much as we could.
It does remind us of some of the reasoning.
It does remind us of some of the corruption within the system by people that, you know what, no matter what system they're in, when they seize power, they're often corrupt. But anyway, Vince Bugliosi, that story will continue. Carmine Savastano will be back in 2 weeks, and I'll be back tomorrow night with the call-in show and B. Pete as my co-host. Until then, remember that I am merely Ocelli, and all of you are indeed the effect. Have a good night.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Air Strikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Carmine Savastano, Human Time Bomb. The violence within our nature poses significant questions and considers the evidence that violence shapes the past and present. Author and professor David T. Beato calls it an impressive tour de force. Savastano shows a mastery of relevant work in biology, anthropology, and intelligence. Each chapter will challenge readers to rethink old assumptions. Doctor of Psychology R. Blackstock notes, "It is a long, hard look into the potency of our collective shadow that is extremely relevant in today's socio-political climate." Historian and author Larry Hancock declares, "This work is a slap on the back of the head, a wake-up call, and a serious reality check as to the true human condition." Order your digital and print copies now on Amazon.com. For more information, visit tpaak.com.